On the morning of May 13, 2011, 6-year-old Timothy Pitson was seen checking out of the Kalahari Resort in Wisconsin Dells with his mother, Amy, but he was never seen with her again. The next day, Amy was found dead in a motel in Rockford, Illinois. She had left behind notes stating that Tim was safe and would be cared for, but that no one would ever find him. 14 years later, Tim's whereabouts remain unknown, and his family is still searching, hoping to bring him home. Hey everyone, welcome back to Detective Perspective. My name is Derek Levasseur. I'm a licensed private investigator and former police detective. Each week I'll be covering an unsolved case in story format. I'll then give you my perspective on the investigation and provide contact information for the individuals or organizations connected to the case so that if you have any tips, you can contact them directly and maybe you can help solve a case. So if you're someone who's interested in true crime, specifically unsolved cases, and you would like to hear my opinion on those investigations, please consider subscribing, whether you're watching on YouTube or listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever platform you use. All right, so I want to go over a couple things unrelated to the case. So if you're not interested in that, please just skip forward, 5 or 6 minutes, and I'll get right into the episode. But for everybody else who's still here, first off, I want to talk about CrimeCon. It was an unbelievable weekend. I got to meet a ton of you. Had a lot of feedback about the show and what you thought about it and where you think we can go from here. I also got to meet multiple families, some of which I've covered their loved ones' stories right here on this channel. I got to meet Megan Trussell's parents, Joe and Vanessa. And in fact, after meeting with them, hearing about the story again in person and seeing where it was right now, we actually did a Crime Weekly News Live, Stephanie and I, and covered her case right there on the spot with Vanessa in the audience. And she actually got up a couple times and gave some comments and filled in some blanks for the audience and got a standing ovation at the end of the episode. In fact, I was so inspired this was not planned, right in the middle of the podcast, she had mentioned that I had promised $1,000 to match their $1,000 reward. And in that moment, just feeling the emotion of a parent and what Vanessa was going through and her words and how they were resonating with me, I upped it to $5,000. So as of right now, there's a total of $6,000 available for reward for any information leading to the arrest and conviction of someone in Megan Trussell's case. And to me, that story is just so incredible and really encompasses, in my opinion, what CrimeCon's all about. There's a lot of content creators there, so it allows families who have experienced tragedy to get to a lot of different people in a very short period of time. And as content creators, it allows us to meet the people we're talking about, which I think is extremely important. It reminds you that the people you're talking about are not characters. They're real people who have experienced real loss. So when you're covering their cases, you have to treat it like that, because this isn't just something for your channel or your podcast. These are people's lives and they're affected by it every day. So when you cover their case, you have to keep that in mind. And what better way to do that than knowing who you're actually talking about because you've met them? And to make the weekend even that much more of just a dream, we actually won Content Creator of the Year for Crime Weekly. And we've been nominated 3 years in a row now. It was kind of a running joke. We did not expect to win this year. We were up against some very heavy competition and we won. We got to present an award in front of Ice-T. John Quinones from What Would You Do actually presented our award. It was a fairy tale weekend. We had a lot of our team members out there. We got to sit down and talk and have some good meals, meet some really interesting people. It was a beautiful hotel. And I strongly recommend, if you haven't been before, definitely try to get out there. The next one is in Vegas. I will be there. Stephanie will be there. And we hope that you can make it. But again, I just wanted to say thank you so much. Thank you to everybody who supports this channel, who supports Crime Weekly, and allows me to do what I do, because it's not something I take for granted. I know I say it to you guys all the time, and maybe you're sick of it by now, but I wouldn't be here right now if it wasn't for you. So that is something that every week when I come in here, I remind myself of that this is not a burden, it's a privilege. And I treat every case that way. And I'm absolutely honored that you guys allow me to do this for a living. So again, thank you for allowing me to make this my career, to make this my life. I'm extremely fortunate. And the only other quick thing I wanted to mention is I apologize for the tardiness with this episode. We had some technical difficulties. The recording device didn't work well. And then now I'm here re-recording the episode, which I have no problem doing because Timothy's case is something that has to be told. It's going to be very interesting to get your feedback on this one. There is evidence in this investigation, but depending on the lens you look through, you may view the exact same evidence and come to a different conclusion than the person sitting next to you. And I find myself as I read this over and over on one occasion saying, oh, it's definitely this. And then reading it again at a different time, maybe I'm in a different mind state and I'm saying, okay, you know what? Maybe it could be this. So I really want to get your feedback on this one because I personally think that the audience is going to be divided, but maybe I'm wrong. I don't want to waste any more time. Let's dive into this week's case. Timothy James Pitson was born on October 18th, 2004 to his parents, Jim and Amy. His name was spelled with two M's because they wanted him to stand out a little bit. And this was also because Amy's brother died at a very young age and his name was Timothy as well. So they named him after Amy's brother, but they wanted to make it a little bit different. They wanted to make his name his own. Growing up in Aurora, Illinois, which is outside of Chicago, Tim was a smart, funny, and outgoing child. He loved going to the zoo, riding his bike, go-karting, and playing with his collection of Matchbox cars. He was full of energy and curious about the world. Jim told Crime Watch Daily that Tim got, quote, along with everybody. He's not afraid of anybody and says everybody is his friend, even if he doesn't know them. In August of 2013, Tim started kindergarten at Greenman Elementary School. By May of 2011, he was 6 years old and ready to graduate from kindergarten. But before that could happen, he disappeared. On the evening of May 11th, Jim called Aurora Police to report Amy and Tim missing. He explained that earlier that morning, just before 8 a.m., he and Amy had dropped him off at school. Jim then drove Amy to work, which wasn't their typical routine, but Amy had left her car at her job after going home sick the day before. At 10:30 a.m., Jim went back to pick Tim up from school since it was a short day. But when he arrived, he learned that Amy had signed him out at 8:15 a.m. after telling the staff that there was a family emergency. According to the Chicago Magazine, Jim knew nothing about this emergency, so he called Amy multiple times, but his calls went to voicemail. When he still hadn't heard from her by that evening, he called the police. Officers informed him that he needed to wait 24 hours, and if Amy and Tim weren't back by late morning, then they would meet up with him. Now, I know some of you right here are jumping through your screen or your earbuds or whatever you're listening on. I hear you. Time is of the essence here. You're talking about a child. If they are in a bad position, minutes could be the difference between life and death. And so I understand not wanting to file the report. I wasn't on the phone call, so I don't know what Jim's tone was at that time. And if he had maybe said, listen, I don't think they're in trouble, but I just wanted to make a note of it. We don't know the exact call. But at minimum, at this point, I think law enforcement should have stepped in and said, hey, give us the number. Let us make some calls. Let's see if we can get her to pick up by leaving a voicemail. And who knows, maybe this would have changed this whole situation and Amy would have decided to come home, or maybe her not picking up or not returning a phone call after they left a voicemail. Maybe that would have created more of a sense of urgency for law enforcement to take the next step and maybe enter them into the missing persons database at that point to try to get a jump on this. But they didn't do that. And by late morning of May 12th, Amy and Tim were still missing. So Jim met with the officers in person and explained that when he first found out that Amy had picked him up from school, he wasn't immediately concerned. He went on to say that Amy had a history of shutting him out when she was upset. And at the time, she was angry with him because they were arguing over a recent trip she had taken to the Bahamas. She had gone on a cruise with a friend and didn't allow Jim or Tim to join, which caused a rift in the marriage. Jim further told officers that while Amy had left before when she was upset, she had never taken Tim with her. Even so, he didn't think anything was seriously wrong at first, and that's why he was hesitant about calling law enforcement. But as time went on and Amy still didn't respond or come home, Jim grew more worried, and that's when he called Amy's sister to see if she had heard from her, but she hadn't. According to Chicago Magazine, Jim put off calling the police for as long as he could, still hoping Amy would get in touch with him, but she never did. So that's when he reported them missing. Before leaving, officers asked him for photos of both Amy and Tim, and they told him they would file a missing persons report for both and would contact him if they learned anything. Jim continued to try and reach Amy, but she didn't answer any calls until the afternoon of May 13th, more than 2 days after she picked him up from school. Between noon and 1 p.m. on the 13th, she called her mother and said everything was fine, explaining that she was upset and just needed some time alone. Not long after that, she called Jim's brother Chuck, and he could hear Tim in the background, and Amy even let him speak with him briefly. And Tim sounded completely fine. Chuck urged Amy to call Jim, telling him he had a right to know where they were, and Amy responded, quote, "Tim is my son, and I can do what I want." As soon as the call ended, Chuck immediately notified Jim, who then tried calling Amy over and over, but she didn't answer. And no one ever heard from Amy or Tim again. The next afternoon, police came to Jim's door with devastating news. Amy had been found dead in a Rockford motel about an hour and 15 minutes from Aurora. To make matters even worse, Tim was not with her. We have a lot more to talk about. We're going to get into it right after this break. Your nighttime bedroom temperature has a huge impact on your sleep quality. If you wake up too hot or too cold, I highly recommend you check out Miracle Made's bed sheets. Miracle Made sheets are inspired by NASA and use silver-infused fabrics that are temperature-regulating so you can sleep at the perfect temperature all night long. Traditional bed sheets can harbor more bacteria than a toilet seat. It can lead to acne, allergies, and stuffy noses, and overall, I think we can agree, it's just gross. Miracle Made offers a whole line of self-cleaning antibacterial bedding such as sheets, pillowcases, and comforters that prevent up to 99.7% of bacterial growth and require up to 3 times less cleaning. So yes, these sheets are temperature regulating, self-cleaning, and most importantly, extremely comfortable. I would even say luxuriously comfortable, but without the high price tag of other luxury brands, and feel just as nice, if not nicer, than some of the sheets I've slept on in 5-star hotels. So head on over to trymiracle.com/detective to try Miracle Made sheets today. And whether you're buying them for yourself or as a gift for a loved one, if you order today, you can save over 40%. And if you use my promo code detective at checkout, you'll get 3 free towels and save an extra 20%. And Miracle is so confident in their product, it's backed with a 30-day money-back guarantee. So if you aren't 100% satisfied, you'll get a full refund. So upgrade your sleep with Miracle Made by going to trymiracle.com/detective and use the code detective to claim your free 3-piece towel set and save over 40%. Again, that's trymiracle.com/detective, code detective, to treat yourself. Thank you to Miracle Made for sponsoring this episode. All right, so we're back, and as officers are talking to Jim at his home, they explain that Amy had checked in late the night before between 11:15 and 11:30 p.m. And at the time, she was alone. And then just after noon the next day, a maid entered the room to clean it, and that's when they found her body. And I do want to give a little bit of a warning here. If anybody is sensitive to talking about suicide or would rather skip this part, completely understand. I'm going to go through a few details here. It's not too graphic, but still, if it's something that you'd rather not hear or watch, just fast forward about 30 seconds and we'll be through it. So when police entered the room, they found a box cutter under the bed, and they determined that Amy had used it to cut her wrist and her neck. And from what I also found, she may have taken some pills before cutting her wrist and cutting her neck. And they did later do some testing of that box cutter and confirmed that the blood on it belonged to Amy and nobody else, not Tim or any other unidentified people. In addition to the box cutter, police also discovered Tim's child identification card along with a suicide note. Now, the full letter has never been released, but parts of it have been shared publicly. What we do know is that Amy apologized to the motel staff for the, quote, mess she created. She also sent letters to her mother and her friend she had recently traveled to the Bahamas with. These letters also haven't been released in full, but some details have been shared. Amy wrote that she never felt like she belonged in the world. She said, quote, "I felt for a long time that I belonged with Timothy, but in the end, that wasn't even enough, and I need to go." In both letters, she insisted that Tim was okay, and to her mother, she wrote, quote, "I've taken him somewhere safe, he will be cared for, and he says that he loves you. Please know that there is nothing you could have said or done that could have changed my mind." You know, this is really sad. I know on one hand, we're talking about Amy taking a young child and at this point not knowing if he's dead or alive. On the other hand, I think about her and her mindset at the time, and I do believe what she's writing in this letter for the most part is true, especially about not feeling like she belonged in the world. And I can't imagine being in that headspace where you think like the only way to fix this is to end your own life. But it happens all the time, and suicide's becoming more of a problem every single day, especially with the things going on in our world today. I think a lot of people feel depressed and a lot of people feel lost. So I try to separate the two here because on one hand, I don't agree with Amy's decision to take Tim away from Jim. On the other hand, I'm compartmentalizing it and thinking about how Amy was feeling. And regardless of what happened, I wouldn't want anybody to feel that way. It sounds like a horrible place to be in. So that's the conundrum I'm in right now, because on one hand, I want to know more about Tim. On the other hand, I'm thinking about Amy and the fact that she felt this was the only way. As you can imagine, Jim's trying to process all of this and he's stunned to learn that his son is still missing. However, he could believe that Amy had taken her own life, and so could her family. You see, Amy had battled severe depression for years before Tim was born, and she had attempted suicide twice. After the second attempt, she was prescribed medication for anxiety and depression. She also found out that she was pregnant with Tim, and for her, the pregnancy felt like a sign that she was meant to live. Her sister told Chicago Magazine that having Tim changed everything. She said, quote, "It was like all of a sudden her life had meaning. Being a mother gave her purpose, and her depression improved drastically." Friends and family said Amy was infatuated with Tim. Jim said she, quote, "just adored that little boy, and he just adored her. He was the apple of her eye, and they were inseparable." As Tim entered school and became more independent, it seemed like Amy's depression returned. She was still loving toward Tim, but her marriage with Jim became more strained. Arguments grew more frequent, and when things got bad, Amy would just shut Jim out and spend time away from home. On top of that, in the weeks before she and Tim disappeared, Amy had stopped taking her medication. Obviously, that was a serious concern because without it, she wasn't herself. Jim told Chicago Magazine, quote, "She'd act real funny, big highs and lows. She would become really emotional." And as far as I can tell, Jim also learned that she was talking to her ex-husband as well. As she had been married multiple times, I believe 4 times, and Jim had found some correspondence between her and her ex-husband where they were making plans to potentially hang out when Jim was away. So this was also something that was a strain on their relationship because I believe Jim had confronted her about these conversations. So as you can see, there was a lot going on leading up to this incident. But at this point in the story, nobody knows where Tim is, and that's what's most important here. So investigators working to find Tim, they processed the motel room for evidence, but Amy's phone wasn't there. It was eventually recovered, but it wasn't until years later and it had been discarded off a highway. And as far as I can tell, unfortunately, nothing useful came from it. I don't know if they couldn't recover the data off of it, if the phone had been scrubbed prior to them finding it, or if it was so badly damaged they couldn't even turn it on. Or did they get into the phone? Did they pull everything off of it and there was just nothing there of value? I have a hard time believing that if the phone had been discarded and it wasn't scrubbed beforehand, you would expect to find something on there. So I tend to lean towards the theory that they found the phone, they tried to extract the data, but unfortunately they were unsuccessful. The Charlie Project also reported that Tim's Spider-Man backpack, along with his toys and clothes, were also missing from the room and have never been found. Now that detail gave police hope that Tim was still out there and he was still alive. Amy's Ford Expedition was parked outside the motel and the car was visibly dirty with plants and weeds stuck underneath it. Tim's car seat wasn't inside, and at first, investigators hoped Amy had given it to whoever she possibly left Tim with. But unfortunately, they later learned that Tim's grandmother was actually in possession of the car seat, and she had been holding on to it for about a week before he went missing. In the backseat of Amy's expedition, investigators found a concerning amount of blood. But according to NBC, Amy's family told investigators that the blood was most likely from a severe nosebleed Tim had suffered in the car not long before he disappeared. And I will say that the blood was confirmed to be Tim's. It's dried blood. They can't determine how long it had been there. If they're saying it's a nosebleed, then I have to believe them. But I will say having that amount of blood in the backseat under these conditions, to me, it's still concerning. And I do want to say that the family did insist that Amy would never hurt her son. And everyone who knew her agreed with this notion. But I also think before this incident, they probably all would have said that she never would have taken Tim and just vanished for 3 days without telling anyone where she was taking him. And then she would take her own life, leaving everybody to wonder what happened to Tim. I also don't think they would have said that. So considering the situation that we're currently in, I respect their opinions on the matter that she would never hurt Tim. But based on what we know so far and based on the fact that we can't find Tim, I just can't sit here and objectively rule out that possibility. So with Amy dead and 6-year-old Tim still missing, Aurora Police brought in the FBI, the U.S. Marshals Service, and several other agencies to help with the investigation. They began piecing together a timeline of Amy and Tim's last movements. So here's what we know. On May 11th, Amy picked Tim up from school at around 8:30 a.m., and by 10 a.m., she had stopped at an auto repair shop to have some work done on her SUV before the long drive she had planned. While the car was being serviced, a mechanic dropped them off at Brookfield Zoo, one of Tim's favorite places. They returned at 3 p.m. to pick up the SUV, and then they drove north to Key Lime Cove Water Resort. The next morning, May 12th, Amy and Tim drove about 2.5 hours to Kalahari Resort in Wisconsin Dells. According to the Chicago Tribune, they stopped for gas and drinks along the way, and they also stopped at a convenience store where Amy bought Tim new clothes, a toy car, and a craft kit. On May 13th at 10 a.m., surveillance cameras showed Amy and Tim checking out of the resort, and you could see Amy holding his hand and looking through the Spider-Man backpack as he fidgeted beside her. Jim also reviewed that same footage and said that Tim, quote, was happy and didn't seem to have any distress or anything. But unfortunately, this surveillance footage is the last confirmed sighting we have of Tim. After leaving Kalahari, Amy drove about 170 miles southwest, and around noon, that's when she called her mother and then Jim's brother Chuck. And as I mentioned earlier, Chuck could hear Tim in the background, and then Tim actually got on the phone, and this was the last time that Tim spoke to any family members. According to the Daily Chronicle, investigators traced the call to an area 5 miles northwest of Sterling, Illinois. Now, Sterling is a small town surrounded by farmland near Route 40. Records suggested that the calls were made from inside the expedition, likely after Amy pulled off to the side of the road. As soon as the call ended with Chuck, Amy turned off her phone and drove into Sterling. And her family isn't sure why she went there. They didn't know of anyone that she knew from that area. And we're going to talk more about it and what this all means right after this break. In every true crime story, it's the little details that give someone away. A receipt, could be a phone ping, or a habit they just couldn't hide. So here's a question for you. What's your habit saying about you? If you're ready to ditch the dead giveaways, start with Fume Zero, the better thing to reach for. This episode is sponsored by Fume Zero, the brand new grab-and-go flavored air device from Fume. And here's why it's different. It's affordable. Just $24.99 for a sleek, pre-filled device, no commitment, no refills, no batteries. It's completely clean, zero nicotine, zero vapor, just natural plant-based flavored air. And it's the first truly easy way to try the good habit. With 6 bold flavors and 10 days of use, Zero makes it simple to start. So take zero chances with Fume Zero today, available for just $24.99. All you have to do is head over to tryfume.com, that's T-R-Y-F-U-M.com, to start with Zero. So before break, we were talking about Amy's last call to Chuck, Jim's brother, and how she had turned off her phone after that call and possibly headed into Sterling, Illinois. And as the family said, they don't know of anyone that Amy knows in Sterling. There's no landmark that she had been to before that she would want to visit. There's no residence that she had visited that she might want to go back to. It's not really a sightseeing place. So to this day, nobody knows the connection between Amy and Sterling. But when investigators checked Amy's iPass, which is like her toll pass, they learned that she had taken two secret trips to Sterling in the months before Tim disappeared. And as you would expect, investigators considered the possibility that she had been scouting this area, possibly looking for a location and a potential time to hand Tim over to someone she trusted. And those two trips became one of the few solid leads investigators still have in this case today. Because as I sit here right now, we still don't know the connection between Sterling and Amy. What does it mean? According to her friends, she didn't know anybody out there. It's farmland. There's not a lot out there to go visit, to do. So why was she up there on two separate occasions? Was she meeting someone? Had she already met someone who lived in that area? Or, as investigators have hypothesized, was she looking at this location for a potential meetup point? Now, on the other hand, and I'm sure some of you are thinking this as well, worst case scenario, was she looking for a place where she could leave Tim? And that would be after killing him. So to me, these are all on the table, and that's why these two previous visits are so important. I wish Amy was here to talk to us, but unfortunately she's not. And we're talking almost 14 years later and we still don't know the connection. We may never, but I do think it's still important. And we're going to talk more about why these locations are so important when we get into the perspective. Now, as far as Amy's exact movements for the rest of May 13th, it's unclear. At 8 p.m., surveillance footage captured her at a Family Dollar in Winnebago near Rockford. She was alone, and she bought stationery and envelopes, likely to write her final letters to her family and friends. She then stopped at a nearby Sullivan's Foods before driving to the Rockford Motel, where records show she had checked in between 11:15 and 11:30 p.m. And as I mentioned earlier, her body was discovered 13 hours later. After investigators pieced together this timeline and reviewed the surveillance footage, they realized that several items were missing from the motel room. Two of those items were Amy's iPass and the clothes she was wearing when she checked out of the Kalahari Resort. Both these items have still never been found. As far as Tim is concerned, after learning that he had last been heard from when he and Amy were near Sterling, multiple agencies searched remote roads and parks along I-88 and I-39 corridors nearby, but nothing was found. See, the problem here is the amount of ground that Amy had covered made it nearly impossible to know where to focus the physical searches. Hoping for answers, investigators examined the dirt and plants collected under Amy's expedition. And what they found was, to me, really cool. As a nerd, as someone who loves investigations and loves the forensics of it, I felt like this was really cool to see that we're capable of doing this. So, according to WQAD, experts determined that the SUV had stopped on a gravel shoulder or a turnout off an asphalt road and then backed into an open meadow. The environment pointed to northwestern Illinois, with Lee and Whiteside counties being the most likely locations. And it's important to note that Whiteside is where Sterling is located. And I do want to dive into this a little bit more because I did a little bit more digging on it and I just found what they were able to do here so fascinating. So the way they were able to determine the possible location that this vehicle had been was through a couple elements that had been found underneath the vehicle. One being glass beads from the asphalt road where you'd use these glass beads for the divider, where you'd have that reflective material so you could see it at night when your lights bounce off of it. That was one element they found. They also determined that where the vehicle had been, more than likely, there are birch and oak trees nearby, not over the meadow area where the car had backed into, but somewhere nearby. They also found remnants of Queen's Anne's lace and black mustard plants. And they believe that because of these items being found underneath the car, more than likely the location where this vehicle backed into potentially had water nearby, maybe a stream or a pond. So again, I think that's pretty cool how they're able to take the elements found underneath the vehicle and track it back to a specific location. But overall, I've also seen that even with these elements, it doesn't really narrow down the search pool too much because there are multiple areas that would check off this criteria. So yes, fascinating, something we should definitely be aware of, but unfortunately it doesn't really pinpoint a specific area that we have to focus on in search because that's where Tim could be or that's where this transaction occurred where Tim was handed off to someone that we haven't identified yet. So yes, it's important information to know, but unfortunately it doesn't really pinpoint a location that we have to focus on. But I still think it's extremely valuable because if we do end up tying this to something else, another person or a potential landing spot for where Tim might be currently, if that location happens to check these boxes, it makes that potential information or that lead that we have that much more credible. So something you definitely want to keep in your pocket and you want to be aware of. So the investigation pushed forward, but as the years passed, no trace of Tim was discovered. Still, the family held on to their belief that he was still alive. They did not believe that Amy would harm him. Instead, they believed that she had left him with someone between the phone calls she made and the time she checked into the motel. And the case was pretty stagnant until 2019 when there was an apparent break in the case. You see, a 14-year-old boy from Kentucky claimed that he was Tim Pitson, saying that he had escaped his kidnappers who had held him for 7 years. Unfortunately, DNA testing quickly revealed that he was actually 23 years old, and he was a man from Ohio with multiple mental health diagnoses. And eventually, Jim Pitson did speak out about this deception, saying that when he learned that it was all a hoax, he was understandably extremely angry and upset. And in January of 2020, the man who had created this whole hoax pleaded guilty to aggravated identity theft, receiving a 2-year prison sentence with credit for time served and 1 year of probation. By 2021, 10 years had passed and there still had been no confirmed sightings of Tim. Investigators had no evidence that Tim was still alive, but no evidence that he was deceased either. Because of that, they continued to operate under the assumption that he was still out there somewhere. Jim told Chicago Magazine that he remains convinced that his son will eventually be found. He also shared that he had a theory about what had happened, one that he had shared with police, but wouldn't discuss publicly because he didn't want to tip off anyone that was involved. And although he wouldn't go into specific details, he has given a general sense of how he believes things may have unfolded. You see, he thinks that someone raised him off-grid in a remote location where he wouldn't have access to news reports about his disappearance. Another possibility that he's explored is that Tim was taken to another country. But no matter what possibility crosses his mind, Jim has never wavered in his belief that his son is still out there somewhere, waiting to be found. In May of 2024, 13 years after Tim vanished, the National Center for Missing and Exploited Children released a new age progression image showing what Tim might look like at 19 years old. Jim also shared a message to his son. He said, quote, "Dear Tim, the years apart have been hard. I am so looking forward to us being reunited. There is so much of your young life I have not been able to be a part of while you have been missing. The future is bright, and I look forward to spending time with you and getting to know my son again. Till I see you again, love, Dad." Unfortunately, there have been no other major updates in Tim's case. He remains missing, and his family continues to hold on to the hope that he will be brought home. But until that day comes, they will never stop searching. All right, so let's dive into this perspective, and I'm going to talk about the evidence we have and how it can basically be tied to two different theories. But I want to start with an overall assumption, and I'm hoping that most of us agree with this. Now, if you don't, please weigh in down in the comments. Let me know why you don't agree and why you think it might be something different. But one thing that I'm taking away from Amy's behavior prior to her death is that she had come to the conclusion that she was going to end her life and she did not want Tim to be with Jim. Now, what that means, we can speculate, but overall, she was going to remove herself from this world and she didn't want to leave knowing that Tim and Jim would be together. Now, why is that? Your guess is as good as mine, but that is something that she had concluded. And I think we can take that from not only because of her conversation with Chuck, but also because she jumped through all of these hoops to ensure that Jim wouldn't be able to find Tim. And when I say jump through hoops, we're talking about premeditation, right? First off, she had left her vehicle at her job. She said she was sick and she needed a ride home. It's my belief that she wasn't sick and that she knew what she was going to do. And she kind of set up this diversion so she could leave her car at her place of work, knowing that the next day she was going to take her vehicle and go take Tim out of school. That's number one. We also have the data that shows she had scouted this area of Sterling on two different occasions prior to this incident, showing that there was clearly some plotting, some planning going on. And the question is, was that to meet someone at a specific time and location, or was that to dispose of Tim? Again, both are viable. She also took some measures to scrub her data, right? We know that her phone was thrown on the side of the road. Did she destroy it? Did she scrub that phone before throwing it out in the roadway? Is that why she didn't leave it in her motel room? Very strong possibility. There was also a discovery of a Yahoo email. This was a separate email that none of her family or friends knew about. Investigators were able to find it, but when they did, the inbox had basically been erased and all that was in there was spam email. And according to Yahoo, this is crazy to me, by the way, they're unable to recover deleted messages. Do you believe that? I have a hard time believing that. Like, we can recover our phone data pretty easily. I have a hard time believing that Yahoo, if they wanted to, couldn't find your deleted messages. Now, why would they come out and say they can't find them? Maybe they actually can't, but one reason would be a privacy issue. They don't want their customers knowing that they have the capability of recovering deleted emails. It may deter people from using their service. Allegedly, just my guess. So we have that premeditation, and then we have her turning off her phone while entering Sterling after making her last call. So there were definitely some measures made to distract and divert people and throw them off course, not even talking about the hundreds of miles that she had driven over the 3 days to, again, create this large search area that would almost be impossible to search completely. And that piece of information is concerning to me. I have to be honest with you. Because yes, we have her buying clothes, we have her buying a craft kit, we have her buying toys for Tim. But the fact that she would drive all over this area, maybe it was just to spend one last road trip with Tim. We know that she went to multiple places that Tim really loved, and that could explain it. I could also make the argument that she was doing that so when she disposed of Tim's body, it wouldn't be located. And I want to explore that theory first, because that's one we're all hoping is not what happened here. But clearly, Amy wasn't in the right state of mind. I don't think I'm going out on a limb saying that. And we have seen multiple cases before where a parent will not only kill themselves, but kill their child because they don't want to leave this earth without them. They don't want to leave their child behind with someone else other than them. So you might be asking yourself, well, if she was going to do that, why wouldn't this just clearly be a murder-suicide inside the motel room? That's a valid question. I understand why you would ask that. I can't get into Amy's head, and I always say this phrase, but you can't rationalize the irrational. Maybe Amy wanted to create the perception, even after death, that she wouldn't harm her child, and that somewhere out there, Tim was living a great life. She didn't want people to remember her as the person who killed her own son. I'm obviously hoping this is not the case, but when we go over the evidence that we have, all of this premeditation, and then we talk about the elements that were found under the vehicle, you could take these pieces of this puzzle and put them down and say, okay, this paints a picture of Amy pulling off the side of the road into a meadow where there's a body of water and killing Tim, and then disposing of his body and writing in the letters that he would never be found because he was so well hidden that she knew it would be very difficult to find him. That's one possibility. The other possibility, which I think we're all hoping for, is that she took all of these steps because she had been planning this for much longer than we know. And somehow she was able to connect with a family or a friend or an acquaintance who was willing to raise Tim, because maybe Amy created this perception, this image that Jim was bad for Tim and that maybe he was harmful to Tim. And maybe she was even presenting it in a way where she made these people believe that Jim was a danger to Tim and this was the only option. And if that's the case, that would explain the scrubbing of the data, turning off her phone, not wanting to leave breadcrumbs of where she had potentially been. And I know you're saying right now, well, that could also be because she killed him. And I agree. But if the person that she met with has some connection to Sterling or the surrounding area, that would also explain why she would take these extra steps to make sure that people can't identify the exact location. Because if they did, that might point to a specific person. And if you're in the camp that Tim is still out there somewhere and that an exchange was made where Tim was handed off to someone who would eventually raise him, I think things like her buying toys, clothes, and the craft kit would point to that. I don't understand why you would buy those things if you knew what you were about to do. But again, we're trying to rationalize the irrational. So again, sometimes things are not going to make sense from a practical perspective. We're talking about someone who knew they were about to take their own life. So the measures they may have taken prior to that may not make sense ever, because maybe in their own mind, they didn't even know why they were doing it. They just did it because they wanted to. And I will say this about Jim's theory. If Tim was taken, he's probably right. He would have to be raised off the grid, where Tim would not be exposed to outside influences, would not know what is going on in the world, would not know that people are actively looking for him, because Tim was old enough to know his dad and to know his mom. And at this point, if he's alive, he would be under the belief that both his mom and his dad are still alive and potentially looking for him. So what story was told to him, if he's alive, for him to now at 18 years old, 19 years old, not be looking for his parents? That is something that I grapple with and I struggle with, because I think to myself, if I was 19 years old and I know that the last memory of my mother is her giving me away, I would want to know why, and I would want to know the answer directly from her, not from the person I'm living with. And maybe eventually, if Tim is out there, that's exactly what he'll do. He'll find a way to get away from wherever he is, and he'll go back to the last place he remembers and try to find his parents, and he'll get those answers. And that would obviously be the situation we're all hoping for, because that would lead to him reuniting with Jim. So to close this one out, I'm sure you're all wondering, where do I fall on this one? I've given you both scenarios, and I pride myself on being honest with you guys. I am torn, but if you made me choose, I would say I'm 51% in the camp of Tim is no longer with us. In today's society, with social media being as prevalent as it is, I would think at this point, Tim would be able to make contact, whether that was by phone or through social media or through email or a letter. He was old enough to know who his mom and dad were and that something happened, because the person he's living with now is not mom and is not dad. I can't imagine a story where eventually, even if his mother told him directly, hey, this is what's happening, you can never contact me again, I think any 18-year-old, 19-year-old would say, you know what? I don't care what she said. I'm reaching out. I want more answers. And yet he hasn't. So maybe he's unable to do so, or maybe he's in such a bubble that he's not even aware of what's going on around him. But again, if you made me choose, I think Amy was going through a really difficult time. And as I said, she was going to exit this world, and she wanted to ensure that Tim would never be with Jim. And what would be the only way to guarantee that? Well, that's if Tim was no longer here as well. But I hope I'm wrong. And if I was absolutely positive about what happened here, I wouldn't be covering it. It's why this case is labeled missing. Because regardless of what I think, and it's only slight one way, that doesn't mean that Tim's not out there. And it doesn't mean that we should stop looking for him. Because If he's going to be found, it's going to take one of you. Investigators have exhausted all resources. They need new leads. And that means one of you have to come forward and get this case going again. So, just to recap, 6-year-old Timothy Pitson was last seen on the morning of May 13th, 2011, checking out of the Kalahari Resort in Wisconsin Dells with his mother, Amy. Later that afternoon, Amy made phone calls to her family, and Tim spoke directly to his uncle. That was the last time anyone confirmed he was still with her. The next day, Amy was found dead in a motel in Rockford, Illinois. In her final notes, she said that Tim was safe and would be cared for, but that no one would ever find him. To this day, Tim has never been located, and at the time he disappeared, he was 6 years old, 4 feet, 2 inches tall, and about 70 pounds with brown hair and brown eyes. He was last seen wearing green or blue shorts, a brown t-shirt, white socks, carrying a Spider-Man backpack. If you have any information about Tim or his disappearance, please call NCMEC at 1-800-843-5678 or the Aurora Police Department at 1-630-256-5516. My final thoughts, as always, go out to Tim's family, specifically Jim. Jim, the reason I decided to cover this case is because I do think it's still very possible that Tim's out there somewhere. And as a father myself, I would spend every breath that I have left in my body trying to find him. So please don't let my assessment deter you. Like I said, 51%. That means another 49% of me still believes he's out there somewhere. And if there's anything that I can do to assist in this case other than covering it how I just did, just know I'm here for you. And now everybody listening and watching is here for you as well. And I really hope sooner than later, I get a call or an update that Tim has been found and you guys have been reunited. Nothing would bring me more joy. That's going to do it for me, guys. Until next episode, everyone stay safe out there. I'll see you soon.